Hey guys, my name is Alex, and you're listening to the Thousand Movie Project podcast. This is a fraught topic, so we don't need to get very much into the weeds about it, but I thought it was interesting to notice this week during the first official day of Donald Trump's trial in Manhattan, where he's being charged with violation of kind of abstruse violation of campaign finance law. It has something to do with how he paid Stormy Daniels, the porn star, $100,000 to never go public with the story of how they had a quick sex while Trump's wife Melania was home with their newborn son. In the first day of the trial, we heard not only the opening arguments of both the defense and the prosecution, we actually heard testimony from the first witness. And that witness was David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, longtime friend and confidant of Trump. Mr. Pecker finally dropped from the former president's small-fisted grip and told the story of times in the past when he has done the man's dirty work. Retired and under oath and wanting to put all this behind him, Pecker opened his mouth wide and came clean, saying that on two occasions prior to this one, he had, at Mr. Trump's behest, purchased the stories of a doorman, for instance, who claimed firsthand knowledge of an illegitimate child the former president had fathered, and the story from a Playboy model about the year-long affair that she and Trump had sustained. When asked by the prosecution why he hadn't personally gone and paid Miss Daniels for her story, he said it was because Mr. Trump had not yet reimbursed him from the last woman to whom he paid tens of thousands of dollars to keep her affair with Donald Trump a secret. But again, it's a fraught issue. I just thought it was interesting. We didn't have to dwell on it. But having touched on the subject of David Pecker and the trial in Manhattan, what I did want to briefly revisit is the subject of Trump's genitals, particularly as they appear in Daniels' memoir, Full Disclosure, where she says, quote, "He knows he has an unusual penis," this is Trump. "It has a mushroom head, like a toadstool, a dick like the mushroom character in Mario Kart," end quote, whose name, incidentally, is Toad. And when this memoir was about to come out, that passage, probably that whole chapter about her affair with Trump, was leaked to the press. And that paragraph in particular, where she describes his penis, kind of became like a trending topic on Twitter, naturally, but so did the character Toad. In fact, before the end of the morning, Toad was pretty much like an inside joke on Twitter, and then Toad himself began to trend. And when Toad was trending, Nintendo got notified, because Nintendo, of course, owns Super Mario Brothers. Nintendo noticed that Toad was trending, and apparently they had no idea why. Sometimes there is no reason why. It sometimes just so happens that, totally unrelated to anything in the news, many people in many places are just talking about Mario. And so Nintendo, seeing this as sort of a silver or bronze caliber opportunity for marketing, they jumped on Twitter and they were like, are we talking about Toad today? Everybody talking about Toad? And they flooded Twitter with pictures of Toad, all small and smiley and poised for attention, having no idea that they had just become a major accelerant in a global dialogue about the president's penis. There were other interesting details from that chapter, like, for instance, Trump telling Stormy Daniels, "You're so beautiful, you're so smart, you remind me of my daughter," shortly before they had sex. He also went on a riff with her about how much he hates sharks, that he gives lots of money to charities, but that the only shark-related charity to which he would ever donate money is a charity that was committed to killing all sharks. As much as I'm compelled to laugh at it, I realize too that when you're in bed with somebody, you are likely to say things that maybe don't make a lot of sense. And sometimes the way that you confide things is you just think out loud, because I don't think most of us have ready linguistic access to what it is that we're feeling. It's just like this sort of tidal, our emotions are like this tidal churning way deep down in some part of the mind that is like pre-linguistic. And in order to access those emotions, you kind of have to talk your way into them. And so when you're in a private situation and you feel safe enough with your companion that you can do that kind of thing, the reason it feels liberating is because you're not dragging all of your thoughts through the various filtering mechanisms that you employ in daily life. Even if it wasn't literal, it's telling. It's very telling, I think, that the first metaphor that should come to mind is, I want to donate money to a charity whose sole purpose is to kill sharks, I just think there are layers to that fantasy. First of all, it shows fear. Because why would anybody hate a shark unless they were afraid? And it shows that the fear is disguising itself in his own mind as contempt. That he goes around thinking he hates sharks, when really, like, a shark has never stepped out of an alleyway with a pistol and said, give me all your money. I know everybody says about, you know, Manhattan in the 70s, it was a different place. And yet he really believes that he hates sharks, like, as individuals or as a species. But that's like saying that you hate wind. Hatred is an interpersonal dislike. You can dread a shark, or you can dread the wind. You can be frustrated and inconvenienced and even enraged by it, but you can't hate it because it has no properties that can, like, offend some tenet of your belief, of your moral code. You can, however, I think, this is an off-the-cuff conception. I think you can hate a piece of art, on the other hand, because a piece of art reflects the sensibilities of its human creators. As I now participate in this Trump Daniels conversation, I realize too that as soiling as this all seems for the people who have to tell this story, who have to talk about what they engaged in, Pecker looks like shit coming out of this, Stormy Daniels doesn't look great, and that chapter in which she recounts her time with Trump is so laden with regret. She's like, I don't know what I was doing there. I was so naive. He made remarks about how he was going to put me on Celebrity Apprentice, and I actually believed him, and it's part of why I went on corresponding with him for another year. Trump looks awful. Michael Cohen looks awful. And here I am talking about it. And there is some little squeeze of shame. And I ask myself, like, how would I feel if I was Trump and I had said those things in an intimate situation and now everybody's talking about it? And yeah, I wouldn't feel good. But then the next part comes. If he does feel humiliated, if he feels betrayed, if he feels violated, those things can be traumatizing, sure, but they don't amount to material consequences. But in thinking that, oh God, it's just the nature of this guy, that no matter who wants to discuss him on whichever topic, he is so embattled with scandal, he drags it around everywhere like a fucking necrotic tail, that it kind of poisons whoever is talking about him, and it gets people worked up and it creates friction in all these relationships. I think there was a poll saying that something like 70% of people in the country have had a divisive moment with a loved one about Trump. But the way that I've kind of started to think about it is not that his own crudeness and bad behavior is itself contagious, but that all of the vulgarity, all of the vitriol that the mention of his name triggers from people is almost like an animalistic response against the fact that this dude is so untouched, kind of like what we were talking about with O.J. Simpson the other day. He's committed so many crimes. He has been so crude and so mean. And yet, he not only eludes the powers trying to impose consequence, he amasses an enormous following of people who, even though they don't have much, will gladly, willingly, consistently give him money out of their own pocket, donating $25, $50, $200 to a billionaire, an alleged billionaire, who claims to love them and to suffer on their behalf. And then there's the average person going to work, trying to abide by their own moral code. Maybe they go to church, maybe they just hang out with friends, or they're politically engaged in such a way that helps them to reaffirm their own priorities, what they believe in, what they think is right, and what they think is wrong. And to have the daily news dominated constantly with the portraiture of this guy who just consistently breaks the law, who is consistently mean and vulgar, who pisses on anything that you might consider a moral code, and yet he seems spared of anything approximating the sorts of inconveniences that confront us every day. And so I think the vulgarity and the raging and the ranting is a kind of cathartic reaction. It is 3 p.m. and I am in traffic. I've been in traffic a lot today. I'm on my way to my third thrift store stop of the day, and traffic has been really, really intense. A train stopped across Bird Road, and I was at one traffic light for 30 minutes. Being in traffic, your mind wanders because there's not much stimuli, and it got me thinking about something. You know, you start making lists in your head and winnowing them down. You just come up with superlatives. What's the best this? What's the best that? My favorite quote by Will Smith, and there's a few of them. It comes from one of his motivational speeches. I think this is all confined to the 90s when he was doing those motivational speeches. This is the quote. He goes, Confucius said one time, he who says he can and see he who says he can't are both
probably right. And the reason I like that quote so much is not just because it's a great distillation of the point, and it is true, it's wise. I really like that argument. My favorite part, though, is the way it begins. Confucius said one time. It's very casual, it's very collegial, and it makes it sound like he and Confucius were chums. This, whatever it was, 6th century philosopher. Confucius said one time. I think about it a lot. Like if I'm in a grocery line and I overhear someone say something with this weird emphasis into their phone, the kind of emphasis people employ when they feel that what they're saying is profound, and I always just think, Confucius said one time. I'm driving through Little Havana right now, and I just saw a TV on the sidewalk, and I was like, that's right, where you fucking belong. I was thinking of being like kicked out of a house, and if I had a spouse who was also an appliance, which one would it be? And I started sort of racking my brain. Would it be a toaster? No, probably not. Would it be a blender? God, no, not a blender. And blenders are often voluptuous. I don't know if it's true. I heard this once that like there are places, I think it was in Iraq, where there was like a showroom for furniture, but they put a towel around the bathtub because they said the bathtub was too voluptuous. Or it might have been one of those bathtubs with like the paw feet. Are there curvaceous appliances? I guess the way I'm thinking about it is like, consider the attributes that are generally seen as like desirable in a romantic partner, and then imagine if those were seen also as being desirable in your appliances. Like for instance, or like pets. I've always thought, you know, in a romantic partner, you definitely need somebody with whom you can converse. And there have been many times in my life where I've always had a dog, pretty much. And like, I would look at my dog and I'd be like, fuck man, I wish you could talk. I wish we could have conversations so I knew what was going on in your head. And I live with Marie. Marie has a dog, it's her dog, but it's kind of like, we are all living together. But every day I say thanks to God that this dog cannot talk. Why is the sky blue? Why do I have to wear a noose when we go walking? Why can't I use the toilet? Why do you use the toilet? Someone told me, I didn't check this out for myself. I have to Google it. I'm sure it's not true that Biden referred to Pete Buttigieg as Pete Booty Shoes. I doubt it. I don't think that happened. But the other day I was sitting with Marie and I started reading this article on CNN, and the headline made it seem like Biden had made the worst gaffe yet. They should have been more mindful of how they like unfolded this article. But so Biden is like on the campaign trail, and I don't know, maybe he was in Pennsylvania or something, and he's telling a Biden story, which means it was very long. And so he's telling weird digressions. And so he's telling the story about how his uncle, I think Flanagan or Finnegan, died in World War II. His plane went down over the forests somewhere, I forget where, and he goes, yeah, you know, and we could never collect the body because they had a big problem with cannibals in that forest. And the headline was like, Joe Biden says cannibals ate his uncle. And then later on, so I'm reading the article and I'm loving it. I'm loving it. I'm really upset. I'm really worried that this spells the end for his campaign. Literally like 5 paragraphs in, maybe more than the halfway point, and that's when like the reporting outlet finally chimes in and says they put their sort of repertorial muscles to work and they did some digging, and it turns out everything Biden said is true. His uncle went down over a forest where they could not then go in and try to salvage the plane or collect the bodies because it was just packed with cannibals. Anyways, I'm pulling up to this thrift shop. I'll be in touch.